So today I'm going to speak on a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. You've all heard of the Bhagavad Gita before? Good. So this is verse number, chapter 4, Transcendental Knowledge, text number 38. Nihidhyanena sadrisham pavitramiha vidyate tatsvayam yoga samsida kalainatmani vindati. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. In this world, there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge is the mature fruit of all mysticism, and one who has become accomplished in the practice of devotional service enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. Purport. When we speak of transcendental knowledge, we do so in terms of spiritual understanding. As such, there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Ignorance is the cause of our bondage, and knowledge is the cause of our liberation. This knowledge is the mature fruit of devotional service. And when one is elsewhere, when one is situated in transcendental knowledge, he need not search for peace elsewhere, for enjoys peace within himself. In other words, this knowledge and peace culminate in Krishna consciousness. That is the last word in the Bhagavad Gita. So in this world, there's nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge is the mature fruit of all mysticism, and one who has become accomplished in the practice of devotional service enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. This is part of the beginnings of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is trying to explain to Arjuna what he should do to solve his bewilderment. In other words, from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has explained that we're not this body. And that as long as we identify with this body, we're going to be bewildered. So how to get out of this misidentification? Krishna has revealed the processes by obtaining transcendental knowledge. The transcendental knowledge is not something you go to the bookstore and get. Nor nowadays can you get it from a university. It is a process of obtaining transcendental knowledge, and it has to do with one's ability to perceive things properly, willingness to perceive things properly. Generally speaking, most conditioned souls, because Krishna has explained that we're conditioned souls. Conditioned soul means that we're actually a spiritual being within a material existence. But we're also overcome by something called illusion. Illusion means that although we're not the body, we're actually, or the mind, we're spiritual beings, but we're also being misdirected by Krishna's very powerful energy called illusion. And part of that illusion is that we think we're this body, or the mind, and we believe that the material world is somehow or another going on, and that there is no God, there's no Supreme Person controlling, and if he is controlling things, he's certainly not controlling my life. He may be trying to control my life, but he's doing a very bad job. So we have certain conceptions about what we think is going on in the world. Who's actually the controller? Is it the Illuminati? It is. Or is it my wife or my husband? Or is it my boss? Or maybe it's my pet dog. Who's actually controlling my life? Who's actually directing my existence? So when we hear that there's a God, and that this God is so powerful that not a blade of grass moves without his desire, it becomes a little disappointing. That whatever I'm doing, I'm like a puppet. I have no free will. God's controlling everything. I'm not really responsible for anything I do because God's the controller. So if something good happens, it's not. I can't take the credit. And certainly if something bad happens, I can't take the blame for it. Because God, he's all powerful. If he didn't want me to do it, he never would have allowed me to do it. So it's his fault. He could have stopped it if he wanted to, but he didn't. Like at the beginning of the movement, there was some devotee, he was dealing with drugs, and he thought, if I can give a proportion of the money to Krishna, then he'd be in on the deal. He'd be a partner in crime. And since he's all powerful, he certainly wouldn't want to get caught. So he used to give nice donations to the temple. But one day he got caught. So then he blamed Krishna. You were a partner. You're supposed to be God. Why did you allow me one of your partners to get caught? So these are misconceptions, a lack of information called ignorance, how Krishna is working, and what is our part that we play? That how can we be responsible and at the same time not be the controller? But that's why the Bhagavad Gita is written, so we can understand. Otherwise they blame God for everything. Or there was one rabbi, as I said before, his name was Krishna, by the way. And his theory was God is a good person, but somehow or another he's become very senile because he's so old. He's the oldest. So he's lost, more or less, advanced Alzheimer's. He doesn't even remember he's God anymore. So, but he's trying to clutch the world, as they have in the Sistine Chapel. He's trying to maintain, but he has arthritis, so his hand is shaking. So he's trying the best he can, but that's why bad things happen to good people, because God just can't get it together anymore. They're trying to get him to retire, but he's detached. After all, he's been doing this forever. It's very hard to give up something you've been doing forever. But there's some hint he might retire soon. One of the younger angels may take over and things should get better. So that's the conception. But actually, there's another conception, is that God can control everything. The question is, what is our desire? In other words, if Krishna has set up the world in such a way, is that we can either turn to him, find out what he wants, and therefore then he'll take responsibility, or do whatever my mind tells me to do, and then it's up to me, then I take the responsibility. Prabhupada used to give the example that in the wars, either World War I or World War II, that the Germans were fighting the English and the French. So the French ladies went to church, and they prayed in the church, "My dear God, please bring back my husband, please bring back my father, please bring back my son from the war." And the German ladies are also going to church, praying, "My dear God, please bring back my father, my son, my husband from the war." But the French, the Germans, as you know, were killing each other, and they didn't come back from the war. So the French ladies, the German ladies, they said, "God doesn't answer prayers. Could be a God. We all prayed so sincerely, and he didn't bring back our fathers, nor our sons, nor our husbands from the war. So there's no God." So they became atheists. But Prabhupada said that actually, The point is, why didn't they ask God if he wanted the war in the first place? That they're causing a war where people are obviously going to get killed. So what can he do about it? That Krishna has allowed, as independent souls, as living entities, we have the capacity to desire. The question is, what we desire. Now, there is Krishna's desire. Krishna actually has desires. He doesn't desire wars. And what a war is caused by? Wars don't just happen by accident. Wars are caused by the fact that people are envious and angry and ignorance, and therefore they'll fight out of misconceptions, out of material desires, material ignorance. And why are they ignorant? Because they've been practicing killing since they're just used to killing. Killing people is not a big thing for people anymore. They're already killing their fellow animals. They've come up with a philosophy. There is no soul. Animals have no soul, so you can kill them. And even if the mother cow is crying when you take away her calf, it's just some kind of it's a chemical reaction. They've come up with, as they say, give the dog a bad name and then hang it. So it's not that their activities follow reality. It's just that their reality follows their activities. They create a reality in order to satisfy their material desires, and then they spread that reality, and then they get the reactions for their mistaken ideas. Because they want lust, they want to fulfill their lust, and they're greed, but they don't want frustration. They don't want anger. But lust follows, greed follows lust, and anger follows greed. And illusion follows anger. And loss of intelligence and memory follow illusion. And therefore they wind up doing things that, generally speaking, are not considered to be proper. But they're convinced by their illusion that they're actually good people, they're doing the right thing, that these people are less than animals, they deserve to be killed, and the best person to kill them is me. They can't recognize that the person that they have feelings, as Prabhupada was saying in one conversation in Bombay with the devotees, he was saying that they're thinking that if I'm an African, I don't have feelings. Or if I'm a European, then I have feelings. But actually, anyone, whether it be a man, woman, animal, bird, everyone has feelings, and when they get hurt, they suffer. And if we think we're learned and we don't even understand that much, that if I hurt someone, they suffer, that means I'm an illusion. I'm ignorant. No matter how much I may have my PhD degree, I may be honored by others as being learned, but actually I'm in ignorance. So real knowledge begins with accepting not only that we're not this body, but no one else is their body either. And that if I get hurt, as I'm hurt, then also others, they also hurt if their bodies, if they're put in an unpleasant situation. And even religions, they also only partially give, many of our big religions, they only partially give information, and therefore they cannot solve any, they don't solve the problems. I remember one time, well, to give one example, is one of the biggest philosophers in the Christian religion, his philosophy is that there's three different kinds of souls. You've heard that before? There's the man's soul, there's the soul in the man's body. He has a full soul. There is the soul in the woman's body, she has a half a soul. And there's a soul, there's no soul in the animal body. Now, nowadays we may become upset. Some people may become upset to hear that women only have a half a soul, but they don't mind to hear that the animal has no soul. I mean, that's really disappointing for the animal. It's twice as disappointing as it is for a woman, having only half a soul. So on that basis, they perform so many activities. I mean, when I was younger, a long time ago, when I was going to college, one of the impetuses to going to college was not so much to learn something, but to stay out of the war in Vietnam. But there was one magazine that had a picture of the U.S. bombing Vietnam. And then their devil was there. And the devil said, "It's hard keeping up with quick Christians." So the point is, if we really want even the most basic knowledge, then we have to have the most simple understanding of things, of reality, and live according to it and accept it. Otherwise, our lives are just being misdirected in the name of so-called progress. So here Krishna explains, how do we get knowledge? Well, in the 34th verse of this chapter, he says, Tadvidi pranipatena pari prashnena sevaya upadeshantite jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshana. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, and render service to him. The self-realized souls can impart knowledge unto you because they have seen the truth. So the point is that Krishna claims that what he's giving is knowledge in Bhagavad Gita. Now we don't have to blindly accept it because it's useless blindly accepting something. Nor should we have to blindly reject it. Because it's also useless. Then if we want to blindly reject it, then there's no sense reading Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, he doesn't need us to read the Bhagavad Gita. It's not that. He came and spoke Bhagavad Gita because he wanted to be number one on time, on the bestseller list. That's not his purpose. His purpose of speaking Bhagavad Gita was to give us an opportunity to make some spiritual progress. That's up to us. And we don't have to blindly reject the Bhagavad Gita, because the knowledge should be obvious. If it's true, it's not that Krishna spoke some philosophy, his philosophy. He spoke philosophy. For instance, when Krishna says our bodies are changing, who's going to dispute that? Can anyone here say that's not I don't believe that? Some people may say that. I know a lot of people who took drugs who used to believe things like that. But that doesn't mean that necessarily their bodies weren't changing, just because we don't believe it. We don't accept it. But everyone can see that our bodies are different from when we were 5 years old, and then now whatever body we have now, and it'll be different in the future too. As a matter of fact, we will have to leave this body sooner or later. But we ourselves within the body, how can we say we're different? We're a different person than when I was 5 years old. How can we? Because how would we remember we were 5 years old if we were a different person? So we're the same. Our body's different. The only sane, intelligent conclusion is we're not the body. And therefore, at the final change of this body called death, I don't die. Because the body is already changing all the time, but I'm not dying. Therefore, I'm eternal. And I won't die when the body dies. Now, I'm going to have to go somewhere, because there won't be a body to be in. Just like, how did I get here, in this body? I must have been somewhere else before I was here. Now, where I was, I don't know. Where I'm going to go, I don't know. But it's probably a good idea to find out. Because I'm only in this body for a very short period of time. But for eternity, from now into eternity, I'm going to be somewhere else very shortly. So if there is a reason, for instance, there are different species of life, there is organizations in this world, the sun's rising at a certain time, setting at a certain time, we eat food, there's a very complicated process by which the food is digested, assimilated, and unnecessary parts are eliminated. There is an organization behind the universe, so there must be some organization behind what happens to me after I leave this body. It's not just we leave the body and there's someone flips a coin and decides heads you win, tails you lose. There must be some reason why we take one body and then have to quit it to take another one. So that's more important to find out that to find out who's going to win the soccer game tomorrow. Because if we don't know what to do for our next, after we leave this body, what value is it who wins the soccer game? Therefore, we should understand what the priorities of knowledge are. What's actually valuable to find out? To find out who's going to win this war, who's going to win this money, who's going to win this fame. What is the value if we don't know where we're going after we leave this body? And how to get to a good place? Just like if you're going to go on vacation, you want to research where is a good place to go. Very few people nowadays buy tickets to go to the Gaza Strip. Go bathing there. Because they research and they find out it's not a very good place to go to. But if they wanted to, they could certainly buy a ticket to go there. And maybe somehow or another they can wind up there. But probably most people after research would want to go to a place like Ljubljana. It would be certainly better. Or Hawaii. Or someplace which is more pleasant. So in order to do that, you have to know where you want to go, then you have to buy the appropriate ticket. And then you have to make reservations. And then you have to get on the plane. And then you wind up there. Not by accident, but because it was our desire. Because we found out the best possible place to go. I remember one time I was traveling in South America, but we would never read the newspaper because we had nothing to do with that. But then I wound up in Bolivia, in La Paz, and when I arrived at the airport, I saw that no one was leaving the airport, so I was quite surprised because I knew nothing what was going on in Bolivia because I was transcendental to all those things. And then I found out at the airport there was a war going on. So I was just traveling to a war zone that I didn't know about. And yeah, I found out there was a war. When I tried to go to the temple, we heard the gunshots, and our driver had to go around the neighborhood because there were blockades and there was fighting going on. So then I decided it wasn't perhaps such a bad idea to read the newspaper to find out if there was a war going on to the place I was going. Then my travel plans might have some kind of modified it at that time. It was an exciting night, though. It was like firecrackers, you know. So in the same way, Bhagavad Gita is meant to give us some knowledge. But in order to receive that knowledge, we have to have some preliminary faith that is worthwhile reading. We don't have to accept it, we don't have to reject it. And generally, that comes from associating with people who have read the Bhagavad Gita and then try to understand what it said. and then applied it with some conviction and some understanding according to someone else that inspired them and directed them. And then when we see that they're happy, they're intelligent, they're organized, they're convinced, then it's attractive. If someone reads a book, Prabhupada used to say for the devotees, they go out and distribute books, and someone asks them, what's in the book? They say, I don't know. Because they never asked me to read the book, they just asked me to come out here and sell the book. So do me a favor, you read the book, and I'll be here tomorrow, you can come and tell me what's in the book. I have no time to read the book. No, we actually become convinced when we see someone who's actually read the book and clearly not only convinced, but actually they become a nice person. They've developed good qualities. They don't just take the book and we understand they're convinced because they take the book and they hit us over the head with it. Surrender to the book. No, we'll be attracted by someone who's developed good qualities by following what's in the book. And then if we want to develop good qualities, we want to develop a clear path for progress in our own life to become happy, because basically speaking, the only thing that people really want is to become happy for as long as they can. No one reads a book to figure out how to become miserable, because you don't have to read a book to figure that out. People will just give you their own experience. But to become happy requires real knowledge. And to become happy for as long as possible, that requires even more knowledge. Nowadays, people want temporary happiness. As I said this morning, there's a website where someone interviewer who's expert at drugs goes to the festivals in America, I guess, and he interviews them about the different types of drugs that they're taking at the festival. In other words, it's to be understood nowadays that no one goes to a festival unless they're taking at least one or two drugs. They'd be embarrassed to go to a festival. Only one person in the whole out of maybe 20 people who's interviewing said he didn't take any drug, but he was going to take it later on. Otherwise, he would be embarrassed that he was weird. So, I mean, they mentioned all these different types of drugs. I don't know what they were talking about. Pharmacology wasn't my major in college. And, you know, you could clearly see that the people that were being interviewed were not exactly on a higher level of consciousness at the time. The only thing they could remember is exactly which drug they took. That was probably their extent of their understanding of reality at that time. And then I didn't see the other part, but there was another part. I mean, there's a whole series of lectures, but what was your worst experience taking drugs? In other words, there are limitations for happiness. Otherwise, why would you take three or four drugs at a time? I mean, powerful drugs. I don't know what they were, but I knew some of them, like cocaine, LSD. Those were in my vocabulary. But they have other drugs. I just don't understand what they're talking about. But they seem to be on the same level. I mean, taking LSD as if you were taking, you know, popping M&Ms is rather, you know, people have gone they've gone a long way in the wrong direction since in a very short period of time. And yet what they're trying to do is simply become happy. But now they can't be happy unless they're in some other world. They used to accuse the Hare Krishnas of escaping. But we're certainly not escaping to where they're going. So they don't know how to become happy. Because they have no clear direction. As I said before, they've come to the point, they don't even know if they're a male or a female anymore. They can't even figure that much out. And if you don't know, when there's 71, at least there's more now, but there used to be 71 different genders, official genders in America. And you have to learn all the genders if you're a university professor. Because if you address one of your students with the wrong gender, it's called microaggression. You've hurt their feelings, which is considered on the same par as if you took a knife and you stabbed them. So if you hurt too many people's with microaggressions, then you lose your job. You're unqualified to be a teacher because you don't know one of the 71 genders that someone might be. And at that moment, how they're feeling. So this is at the universities, the big universities in America, this is where they've come to. This is so-called knowledge. And if you tell someone you're not your body, then you certainly they'll put you in jail for insulting their body. So why all this? Because people want to be happy, but they have no idea how to become happy. They have no idea their own identity as a spiritual being. They're so much absorbed in this body, they can't figure out how to make it happy, either by drugs or by speculation or by diet or whatever they're doing to seek happiness. But on the other hand, for those who are fortunate enough to hear Krishna conscious philosophy from the right source, and if they have the right attitude, then at once they can understand the fact that they're eternal and get a different view on life, a different direction, a different purpose of life. Rather than to endlessly try to figure out how to gratify the senses, they can actually try to figure out how to get out of the false conception where they can arrive at actually a happy place. They can be happy with themselves, they can be happy with everyone else, they can be happy with all living entities. They can actually truly be happy and peaceful if they simply hear from the right source with the right attitude and then become determined to do the right activities, then Krishna will bless them and their actually lives will become auspicious. So that's up to the devotees to give people that opportunity because they're not going to get it from any other source. They're not going to get it from the newspapers, from their friends, they're not going to get it from their parents, only from the devotees if they're kind enough to give them this transcendental knowledge, then they can actually, their lives become auspicious. Otherwise, I mean, if Kali Yuga is supposed to come at the end of 427,000 years, I mean, in just the last 50 years or whatever it is, how much has advanced? Who can imagine what the end of Kali Yuga is going to be like? It'd probably be 3,000 genders by that time. you'll have to have a dictionary to figure out what gender you're talking to. So that's all stuff there. Thank you. Any questions or comments? And the other thing is, if we just chant Hare Krishna, just like there's a Harinam party here, if we're fortunate enough to go in the Harinam party, just by chanting Hare Krishna, the atmosphere will become purified, at least especially for those who go out and chant. But actually, it's the chanting, and if we put Krishna in our heart, and Krishna prema is emanating from our hearts, then people will become affected by it. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in the Jarikanda forest, he didn't preach to the animals. The animals couldn't understand Bhagavad Gita. Besides that, even if they preached to the animals and they understood, he couldn't sell them a book because they had no money. So, instead of that, he chanted Hare Krishna. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he was emanating Krishna Prema, he was in ecstasy. Therefore, even the animals, like the tigers and the deers, were embracing. The elephants were rolling in the ground in ecstasy. Not due to his preaching, but due to his love for Krishna. So similarly, if we develop love for Krishna, then we can actually influence others. If we actually put Krishna in, by our service, by our sincerity, if Krishna appears in our heart and we become ecstatic, we develop love for Krishna and for others, then that will change the world. And there's no other way that the world will change for the better. It's not by going out and protesting. It's not by shouting or revolution. As Prabhupada said, resolution, revolution, dissolution, no solution. The only real way to change things is to put Krishna in our hearts and emanate love of God. Let Krishna emanate love from our hearts, and that will actually affect others. So like the animals in Jharkhanda, the people will, in this city or other cities, they'll also chant, dance and chant along with us. And that will change the world. So I'll stop there. Any questions or comments? Yes, we have a microphone.
Thank you, Maharaj, for the class. My question, in the text it says that you have to accomplish the devotional service to get the transcendental knowledge. So is it a prerequisite to achieve transcendental knowledge?
Well, there are different stages. First stage is to hear theoretical knowledge. It's like we're giving a class in the Bhagavad Gita. So that's also devotional service. I'm speaking, you're listening. That's also one, that's Shravanam. But then the next stage is Kirtanam. Shravanam could be enough if we could hear with perfect attention, but because our activities are not always devotional, therefore it's very hard to concentrate with attention. Therefore we have to put into practice what we've heard. And we can only do that by hearing enough so that we can see what's being said. It actually becomes understood by us, so we know how to apply it within our lives. And then when we apply it within our lives, that's called kirtan. That's repeating. And by kirtan, if we associate with devotees with conviction, by properly understanding what we're doing and how to do it, then realization comes. Then consciousness of Krishna comes, follows that. Krishna reveals himself within our heart because we're doing the right thing with the right attitude.
So this is what accomplishing the devotional service means.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Anything else? Koala. Okay. Bhagavad Dharma.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for lecture. I just want to ask, what is the obstacle that prevent us to apply the knowledge? Is it desires attached on the illusion, or?
Well, generally speaking, it's a number of things. The most important thing is our association. That we already have a false ego, which is we've acquired, and some people's false egos are bigger than others. But our false ego might increase or decrease according to our association. So if we get good association, then it's more likely that we'll accept a real ego as being Krishna's servant, and we'll be able to tolerate our false ego. And the more we tolerate our false ego, the more we accept our real ego, then the more Krishna can work with us.
By tolerating the false ego, you mean like ignoring or that sense, or
seeing it for what it is? We can't ignore it. It's just like we have to see it for what it actually is. But the only way we can see it is to accept a real ego as being the servant of Krishna, and trying that out. See what the experience of the false ego is, what the experience of a real ego is. Anything else? Kala Granthara Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.